Blog Talk Radio.
This is Allah. With God's assistance, we begin. The Muslim American Media Alliance presents Meet the Members. The Muslim American Media Alliance members are professionals, organizations, and businesses in the media industry with a collective mission to share information and network. And now, your host, William Kareem.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another edition of Meet the Mama, the Muslim American Media Alliance members. Yes, this here is the first show of 2013. And as you may or may not know, I know that many of you who are probably listening are from the Muslim community or the African American community, but to all that are concerned, this is the month of February, which here in the United States is celebrated as Black History Month. So it is only fitting that we have with us a guest who will talk to us about some Black history, in particular, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who played a significant role in African-American history and culture. But first, I would just like to let you know that the Muslim American Media Alliance, our members, Muslim professionals, organizations, and businesses in the media industry with a collective mission to share information, network, and present the stories of Al-Islam and Muslims in America through resources in print, music, film, radio, TV, and new media. So today we have with us an imam from Indianapolis, Michael Sahir, who has written a book that is in print, and it's called The Honorable Elijah Muhammad, The Man Behind the Men. And we're going to bring him on. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Imam. How are you this morning?
Alaikum assalam, Brother William Kareem. I'm doing fine, and also greetings of peace to your listening audience.
Yes, thank you. So I thank you for getting up this early. You know, I'm over here on the East Coast, and which is at 12 noon. So we thank you for being up at 9 o'clock in the morning on the West Coast to take this interview.
Yes, yeah, so, well, you know, normally I'm from Indianapolis, which means we're on the same time as New York, but I have the privilege to be here for some book signings in Los Angeles and San Diego. So I'm here at my brother's house named Daoud in sunny California.
That's great. That is excellent. Now, just to give our listeners background on, first of all, this is a very good book, and it's great to know that we have that you have done this this project. And I'm in going through the book and reading it, it came to me that you were inspired to actually do it, to do this book. But before we actually get there, let's just give the listeners some background about who Michael Sahir is. I know that you were that your journey that delivered you to the thresholds of Elijah Muhammad's Islam. You said that you were going to be a Black Muslim when I get grown. And how old were you at that time?
I was 15, 16 years old when I first heard the message, and I made up my mind that as I would have used my vernacular at that time, when I get grown, and I was determined that I was going to be but I understood the term Black, so I was going to be a Black Muslim when I get grown. But praise be to God, now I am a human Muslim.
Yes, but you know, just to understand the circumstances and the situations that you came up in, you did come up in the time when the term Negro in public was being used. Is that correct?
Oh yes, I was one of those converted by James Browns. Don't say a lot on Black Browns. Back in 1968, you know, before, you know, not only was I a Negro, I was a Negro with a capital N, you know, so, and we were colored. So we went through those, the 1960s, even in the history books, called it the turbulent 60s, because it was a difficult time, man. Rice and Watts, Rice in Detroit, he had the white kids out there, flower power, you know, down with the government. So it was a very difficult time for all youth during that time. So we began to search different groups and different thinkers. And what caught my attention the most was the message of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
Yes, and what was so different about that message that a 15-year-old would say something like that, as opposed to some of the things that you may have been hearing in the popular culture or in the from the adults that were surrounding you? What was so different about what you was hearing from Elijah Muhammad that made you make a statement like that?
Well, one of them came to my mind. I recall going to a Sunday meeting at the temple, and the minister was teaching about Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel and how Cain killed Abel, but then Cain went to the land of Nod and got a wife, and the minister asked the question, where did this wife come from? If they were the only three left on earth, then all of a sudden this wife or these people in the land of Nod come from. So it was like stimulating my mind and curiosity on things that I had been hearing all my life. I know 15 years is not a long time, but for me, it was a long time during that period. And so they were asked questions like that. And then, plus, they would address the racial issues that was on everyone's mind, but no one seemed to want to have the openness to talk about, whereas actually Islam made it front and center, you know. So
yes,
for me, it was like, yeah, they all addressed the things that had crossed my mind, but I was pushed out of my mind because
yes,
no one else was talking about it. But initially, Islam was like, no, here it is, front and center. Let's talk about this.
Excellent.
And so for me, I'm like, yeah, this is it here.
You know, I feel
you
the
know?
Same way.
yes,
I had that same feeling at the age of 12, actually.
Yes, sir.
You know, because I was I went to church, and I sang in the choir, and I remember standing up in church. I remember standing up in church and actually asking them. I mean, this was not Sunday school. This was the main church meeting,
right.
And, you know, which happened after Sunday school, and all
right,
the adults and everything was around. And I stood up and raised my hand, and I asked the minister. I asked him the same thing. I said, "Well, if Adam and Eve was the first man and woman on the planet, and they had two sons, you know, where'd the rest of the people come from?" And he said, "Well, Billy, you know, the Lord works in mysterious ways," and everybody started jumping. Yeah, amen. Praise the Lord. Oh, and I'm standing there. I'm still standing up.
Are you
waiting for an answer? And then the next thing you know, he started talking about some eagles. You know, the eagle on the mountain or something. And I just sat back down, but I was very disappointed. I was very disappointed.
Yes,
and I started going to other churches, you know, trying to find something, because I knew that it wasn't there.
Right. Yeah, so it was really similar here. You know, that point and many other points it would take too much time to list, that the Nation of Islam, it was, now in hindsight, we can see the Nation of Islam was created by intent, on purpose, to address areas of dissatisfaction in the African-American soul. So people that were dissatisfied and had the courage to say something, they would find a home and a place in the Nation of Islam.
Now, there was something else that I found that was very interesting, that you had finally decided that you were going to write the book. And you
yes,
mentioned that an incident that happened when you went to the doctor's office and when you went
yes,
to the drugstore. Could
the
you tell us about that?
Yes, sir. Yeah. I was in the process of writing a book. I knew I had to do due diligence in studying and reading other books to help me in my process. So I was reading the book called Elijah Muhammad, An Original Man, written by Andrew Claude Clegg. And really, I recommend that book, too, by the way. And so I had the book with me as I went to the doctor's office for my cold or whatever it was. And I carried it with me to the actual doctor's room to read while waiting for the nurse to come in. And when she came in, I had the book in my hand, and my first mind told me, put the book face down, because, you know, she's a Caucasian nurse, maybe 60 years old or whatever. But then my second mind said, it's only a book. You know, put it face up. And I did, and she came in. She was as nice and friendly and bubbly, you know, and how you doing, and took my blood pressure and took my temperature and all my vitals. And if you turned around to the counter where the book was to write down my numbers, and I can, and she gets look out, she was locked. She saw that cover of that book, and she locked up. And I always say in a jokingly way, I can feel that room go from 72 degrees to about 40 degrees. I mean, it went cold, silence. And when she turned back around to me, her face was like a hardened face. Look on her face. She was kind of like, you know, that picture didn't settle well with her at all. And I said, oh, man, I know I should have followed my first mind and put the cover of that book face down. It was too late. You know, I went ahead and saw the doctor. He gave me my prescription. I go to the pharmacy, get my prescription. I'm going to the cashier now, and behind the counter is another 60, 70-year-old white woman. I said, I'm putting this book face down. I put it face down, but the spine of the book was facing her, and she leaned way back, and she said, oh, this is an autobiography. I love autobiographies, and grabbed the book. I said, oh, my goodness. Here we go again. And so I began to try to explain, well, this is Elijah Muhammad, you know, and he was known for this, and he thought that white folks were devils. But when I said, but, this white lady surprised me. She said, they were devils.
Wow.
I said, oh, my. And then I looked at her, and I guess she read my face. I'm saying, lady, don't you realize that you white? And then she said, at that time, some of them were devils.
Wow.
I said, when I had that nurse, 2 hours later to that cashier, I said, these are the two extremes on Elijah Muhammad. And I feel that me and also many other of us who know, we need to fill that gap, that void of information, because many of us know this history. Many of us live this history. And so these two Caucasian women on the same day, they gave me the two polar ends.
Yes.
Got to fill in.
Yes. You know, that's you know, it's I found that very interesting that I don't want to really jump to Imam Waqfuddin Muhammad, but when you had this experience, it was after you had been under the leadership of the Honorable Imam Waqfuddin Muhammad, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So yes. You know, so Imam, you know, Imam Muhammad had Waqfuddin Muhammad had put some type of inspiration in you, some kinds of ideas in you that made you want to do read, because you're saying that you were reading about the Honorable Master Elijah Muhammad, but you know it. That you actually like got a mission of what you were going to do as far as make a contribution?
Well, you know, that I had wanted to write. I've been a writer for quite some time, you know, for Muslim Journal and other publications. But this began as my capstone. I went to college late in my 40s. So for my final project to graduate, I decided to write a paper with the same title, The Honorable Elijah Muhammad, The Man Behind the Man. And then when I was working on it further, I said, I'm going to make this into a book. And I did get a chance to share the title with Imam Muhammad, as well as a rough draft of a manuscript before he passed. But when I first gave him the title for his opinion on it, he said yes. He said that he liked the title very much. You know, so I wish he had lived to see the final project. But he did see pretty much the whole book because I gave him a copy of the manuscript.
Now,
and also I want to ask you quickly, he gave me two interviews for the book.
Now, the book, you state in the foreword, while Sahar's book does not maintain that Elijah Muhammad was motivated by materialism, his leadership in the Nation of Islam were increasingly shaped by both an emphasis on material concerns and the larger patterns of American society. Toward these ends, Sahar's discussion and analysis advances two major items in explaining Elijah Muhammad's life and views and leadership. The first of these is lengthy discussions of the importance of historical circumstances. What do you basically, how do you figure he fitted into historical circumstances? I know that he had been written out of history, and that's why I really appreciate this book so much, because, you know, it's a reference to give a clear, sober, and I would say even factual idea of who Elijah Muhammad was and what it was that he did and the men that were behind him.
Okay, so if she can just paraphrase that question just one more time.
Yeah, well, you said that there were two. The lengthy discussions on the importance of the historical circumstances and conditions. What were the historical circumstances and conditions that you were trying to express about Elijah Muhammad that made his life, views, and leadership important?
Yes. One thing that I mentioned in the book is that the honorable Elijah Muhammad is just American as American pie. And some people want to see him as being other than or outside of America, but they can't. He was born and raised in America. He was born 32 years after the end of chattel slavery in the Deep South. And if anybody has any connection of the Deep South in particular in the 19th century, it didn't change much at all. So he is very much a product of American history that some Americans may want to forget about today.
So now, are you saying that Elijah Muhammad was born? You said 32 years after chattel slavery. What date are you dating with that?
Well, slavery ended in 1850. I gotta get it right because my great grandfather was 9 when slavery ended. So. The Civil War was what, 1850? You can't help me out here. No.
1864 or something like that.
1864, 1865. Yeah, 1860, yes. And so the Muhammad was born in the 1890s, in the late 1890s. So that's a 32-year difference.
Wow.
From the in the slavery.
Only now, 32 years, right.
Yes. Now, but compound that. We got to add to it and compound that. Because I have the blessing that my mother and father were from Alabama. And so I knew as a youth, as a young boy, what it meant to go down to Alabama. And to give you some idea, my mother's hometown, as you and I speak right now, the population is 400 people. You know, so I personally had a taste of the residue that was left over. The Honorable Muhammad, he was right there on the residue of physical slavery, to where the conditions, you know, the sharecroppers and the and all that, it hadn't changed much at all. Plus, he seen people who he knew hanging from trees, so that they had been lynched. So, America created the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
Right.
Now, they created Elijah Poole. Let me correct that. They created Elijah Poole. Master W. Farrar created
Elijah Muhammad.
Yeah. But Farrar could only take the product of dissatisfaction that was created by an American experience upon African Americans. And when he finally found the student he needed in Elijah Muhammad, then all the other African Americans, even to this day, who find dissatisfaction can come into that process, but it's still an American process. France, Russia, China, Africa, Arabia, they have anything to do with the condition that the African American found themselves in America. So
now,
Elijah Muhammad is an American product. And the history that needs to be, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead. Finish your point.
Yeah, but the history has to be told as it was played out. And so now you take an Elijah Muhammad, or you take the Elijah Muhammad, the honorable Elijah Muhammad. He came from that bad situation, that close to chattel slavery, and rose to build a community of African-American success that no one else has matched, period. He created men and women.
Before you actually go there, I wanted to build just a little bit before you go there.
Sure.
Because we're in the process of moving through this interview, we could see where you have mentioned how the Honorable Master Elijah Muhammad or Elijah Poole came up 32 years after he was born, 32 years after slavery, and then he had to, you know, face the residue of that. And but there was a movement that actually was happening in his life, and this was the which is the second point you make. His second is his significance as a prominent icon of the quasi-Islamic and racial separatist movement. So that means that there was a movement actually going on during his young life, of Islamic movement that was going on. I took that when I read it to be the notable Drew Ali, the Marcus Garvey, et cetera, that was going on during that time. Is that correct?
Very true, very correct. And also, within the African-American experience as a whole, there were other gentlemen that were, that were not too far removed from Booker T. Washington's and Frederick Douglass. There has not been a break in the continuity of this struggle against oppression. But the Islamic flavor came in with, hints of it came in with Marcus Garvey movement, a more pronounced Islamic expression came with the Nobu Jew Ali, and then the Ahmadiyya Muslims as well, though not African-American centered, they still had a major influence upon the African-American growth in a Islamic expression. But there's always been a continuous movement against the wrongs and the oppression done to African-Americans by Muslims as well as non-Muslims. And keep in mind, we know this is Black History Month, and one complaint that most African-Americans have about Black History Month is that the major media only promote certain people. I love Dr. King, and I love him dearly, but we know the major media is not going to show other voices that were just as important in this struggle to take the descendants of ex-slaves and raise us to a position of being truly free. Where Elijah Muhammad was a man, he had over that. He was able to create his own media, his own schools, his own businesses, and was able to overcome that to a large degree, that overcome that resistance by the major media or the major culture to only show one side of our advancement. So the man is super important for the historical factor of giving a rounded view of us as a people coming into freedom.
You know, you said that the Elijah Muhammad's image, as illustrated by Hollywood, the FBI, and through many social commentaries, has been fused. And that's what you're talking about, is that correct?
Yes, and using the words skewed as really being gentle, I mean, the man has been blatantly lied upon, as we know, and it's really a shame that Hollywood, with even with our brother Spike Lee, I know his emphasis was upon Malcolm, but because that's the name of the movie. But when he shows the contributions of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he showed him as being distant, as being showed him coughing and hacking. You know, he shows him as being a manipulator. You know, and so then the other movie came out with Will Smith playing the role of Ali. Once again, they showed Elijah Muhammad as this just an off-balance, hateful man. And so the effort of the book is to show a more complete or a more rounded picture of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, because what he has been able to achieve, no one else has been able to achieve. And so why not talk about that?
Let's talk about Malcolm X or Malcolm Little. And in your book, you say, in most reports on Malcolm's prison life, he is praised for having read the entire dictionary, writing each word, and learning its definition. However, Malcolm's recognition of his insufficient grammar and spelling and his apology to Elijah Muhammad for his poor writing skill strongly suggests that he had not begun his insatiable study of the entire dictionary until after he became acquainted with the teachings of Elijah Muhammad. Could you speak to that?
Yes. Well, and if you listen to that, if you follow it in a timeline or a time sequence, if you're writing, if you have read the whole dictionary and you can't write a decent letter, then it doesn't make sense. You know, here I am, I have studied each word in the dictionary, and I can't write a letter of saying, hello, how you doing? It doesn't make sense. It stands to reason that after he had came in contact with the voice of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, then his appetite for reading was turned on. Because if you study, if you look at Malcolm's life, he was in prison trying to overcome a bad lifestyle, drug habits, you know, and being oppressed by the racial oppression of all black men and women having endured. But after he came into contact with the voice of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, then that freed him. And now Malcolm always had a superior intellect, but he used it for vices and for other bad things. But now he has to turn around when he meets Elijah Muhammad through a letter. And he said he was too embarrassed to send the letter. His handwriting was so poor, he was too embarrassed to send the letter. That doesn't sound like to me someone who has written each word in the dictionary. You know, it doesn't make sense.
Yes, he said, I had been told about him by my brothers and sisters, and I apologize for my poor letter. That was one of the quotes that you actually make, or one of the reference points that you actually make with that. But the other part is, which I found interesting, was that there was something, I can't exactly find the part, but I know that it was saying that everybody knew. He said anybody who was just a novice of the Nation of Islam knew that Malcolm was a product of the Honorable Master Elijah Muhammad, but they always made it look like Malcolm was the leader.
You're right, yes. And even now, if you go and get a tape of Malcolm, or you go, in particular, the ones that were reproduced in the 70s when technology wasn't that good, Malcolm would be talking, and all of a sudden it would jump. You hear a glitch, or you would see a glitch or a jump or in the video or in the audio. And what they were pulling out was this one phrase that Malcolm always, the other Muslim said. Malcolm would say, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us.
Yes.
And then he would speak.
Yes.
And the reason why you hear seeing all these glitches and jumps, because they don't pull it out that part. Well, Malcolm is giving due credit to where his thoughts are coming from.
Yes.
But to make it seem like it was Malcolm's thoughts, it was pulled out, because Malcolm said it so, he said that phrase so much, the phrase,
yes,
the Honorable, like Muhammad teaches us, so much until people would criticize him, say, why you got to say that so often? And Malcolm said that he would get mad at them for even daring to question him when he said that. But after Malcolm had died and those who had other designs and plans for Malcolm and his image, they began to take that part out to let Malcolm get credit for his source. So all of these things from 64 going earlier, Malcolm was only the voice piece for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, because Malcolm was a superior talker. He was articulate. He was quick. He was quick-witted. And Elijah Muhammad said, good, I need this. Now, I'm speaking for him now. You know,
right.
You know, but, and so, and Malcolm was only saying what he had been told to say. And anybody who knows the Nation of Islam, when he got done with a radio show or a TV show or whatever, he had to report back to Elijah Muhammad to get a grade on if he done good or not. Him, Mr. Forcon, and all the big ministers had to report back to the teacher, which was the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But our so-called friends in the media today want to give us the impression that that was Malcolm's thoughts in his speech. It was Malcolm's speech, but it wasn't Malcolm's thoughts. It was the thoughts of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
You know, it's unfortunate, we only have like an hour, but I know that we'll probably be able to go a little longer than that. But let us move on, because I think that this is an interesting chapter to actually cover the El-Hajj Malik Shabazz, which is one of the men that's before the man. So
right, before the man, yes.
Right. Right, but now let's talk about this person whose name is Louis Eugene Walcott.
Yes,
and who is that?
Louis Eugene Walcott was a man that was raised in Portland, in New York. He was raised in Boston, and he came from a very good background for his education, and he was very smart brother in the field of entertainment. He was known as Gene the Charmer. That was his stage name. And some say he was right close to or right behind the talent of Harry Belafonte as the Calypso singer. We know him today as Minister Louis Farrakhan, because he came in contact with Malcolm and heard the message of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And after a time of struggling to go to be a musician and pursue my career, or do I become a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad? And he made up his mind to become a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So the brother who you spoke of, Eugene Walcott, is Minister Louis Farrakhan.
You know, what I find that's very interesting that you write is a quote from Minister Farrakhan that says, where he says, my high school education was so superior that when I went to college, I never bought a book. I never was mentally challenged by anything that was being offered as a course of study. I went there because my mother desired that I have a fallback position in case music failed. So this mm-hmm. was a very smart brother.
Very smart. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think he went to college a year earlier, because he was so smart with the books. You know, he just went right through high school, you know, and then he went to college. He didn't even have to buy a book. He was just that smart. So he goes
now,
on
how
to
did,
say the win. Go ahead.
Could you tell our audience, how did Minister Louis Farrakhan, or how did he actually start connecting with the Nation of Islam? Was it through his music?
I think my research tells me that he had heard Malcolm X speak. And so Malcolm was the one that led him to the Nation of Islam.
So now, what year are we talking about that this happened with Louis Minister Farrakhan or Louis Walcott?
This would be in the mid-1950s.
In the 50s?
Yes, in the 50s.
So Malcolm was Malcolm in what? He was in the 50s also?
Malcolm came, he was in prison in 1952, when he, as a matter of fact, there was 50, Malcolm was in prison when he first heard about the Nation of Islam.
The reason why I'm asking you, because, see, we had talked about the Honorable Master Elijah Muhammad and the movement that was actually going on at that time, which was this this move toward Islam and a separatist, Noble Drew Ali, Marcus Garvey, that kind of movement. What happened with that movement? It was like those did they die off and Elijah Muhammad's movement took effect, and then the next thing you know, we transitioned into another period, which created the Malcolm X era or the Nation of Islam era, the era of Elijah Muhammad?
Well, if you don't, the Nation of Islam era began in Detroit in late 1920s, 1929, 30, 31, and under Mr. Farrar, W.D. Farrar. So, and Mr. Farrar's movement came right after a decrease that we in Marcus Garvey's movement. You know, Marcus Garvey ran in the problem with the government and so on, that caused him to have a hardship. The Moy Science Temple under Noble Drew Ali also was there, and they are still around today, but many of the members in time became followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. This is the 30s and the 40s. And then we would get into the 50s is when we see Malcolm X, because, you know, Malcolm X spent 12 years with the Nation of Islam from 1952 until 1964. So, and Malcolm came out of prison really sharper than many other ministers that were already out. So he really began to rise quickly upon coming home from prison. And in the mid-50s, when they had the encounter with Minister Farrakhan, Malcolm's sister was in Boston, and Mr. Farrakhan was in Boston, so they got a connection back in the mid-50s.
So then could we also say that in the 50s, this was also like the civil rights movement? Would we say that, or was it the start of a civil rights movement that was going on?
It would definitely have to be a phase of it, of the civil rights movement. Because then keep in mind, I know myself, I would assume for most of us, we have been conditioned when we hear the word civil rights to not think of Islam and not think of Elijah Muhammad. That's changing some now, because they have to recognize that the movement for civil rights, and some say human rights as well, it was not just our beloved Dr. King, and it's in the quote-unquote uppercase civil rights movement, that there were many movements going on besides Dr. King's movement to bring African Americans into the freedom that God had given to all people. So if I'm following what you're asking me, is that I would have to say yes, that this particular angle of approaching freedom and civil rights would be right there with the civil rights movement as a whole. And if you read into the book later on, that we see where people like Julian Bond came and asked money from Elijah Muhammad to help get people up to Chicago in 1968. And we also learned that Elijah Muhammad often posted Bond to bail out from jail the Christians, the African Americans who had been locked up as part of the civil rights movement. So we see in the end, as a matter of fact, just before Dr. King passed, we see where he visited the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's home. You know, and so there and Malcolm X went to visit Dr. King, though he didn't see him down in Birmingham, and he was locked up in Birmingham. So we can see, yes, the answer is yes. We can see, yes, quasi-Islamic expression was really a part of the overall civil rights movement to bring about justice.
Stephen Barbosa in American Jihad, Islam After Malcolm X, you write, asked the minister, what does the name Farrakhan mean and how did you get it? His answer, could you tell us about that?
I found that very interesting because Mr. Farrakhan said, quite honestly, he said, I don't know what the name Farrakhan means. He said he asked the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, what does the name mean? And the answer was that he said he would tell him later. He had the answer upstairs. He will let him know later. But however, according to Mr. Farrakhan's interview with Steve Barbosa, that he never got a chance to get back with him to find out the meaning of his name, Farrakhan.
What is it that made Farrakhan stand out? How did he actually establish his position as being one of the men? What were some of the things that made you pick Minister Farrakhan to be one of the men that was, you know, that was molded and shaped by the Honorable Master Elijah Muhammad?
Well, then not so much just shaped, but the four men that I chose, they had not only been successful on the domestic scene within the confines of the United States of America, all four of these men, and the four men being Imam Muhammad, Minister Malcolm X, Mr. Farrakhan, and Muhammad Ali, all four of them had been very successful on the international scene. So I chose them because of that achievement. And with Mr. Farrakhan, he has achieved that. He has an international following. He is internationally renowned as one. And we know that his beginning or his birth was directly from him being a student or a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, as with the other three men. Their success is because of them coming through the shaping and the grooming of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
I do have a question to ask you. It's something that I always wanted to know, and you had sparked my interest when you talked about the materialism of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. When I came into the Nation of Islam in 1972, when I came in, I was very attracted because, being a person that actually came from the streets, hustlers and number runners. I was right up there on 8th Avenue, and these were the guys that were the slicksters. They dressed and they drove the Cadillacs, and, you know, everybody knew them. Everybody wanted to be like them. They were the men, you know, that we aspired to in the community. But when I came down to the mosque and I went to sit in the temple and I saw all these, black men, African-American men, these black Muslims, dressed with suits and bow ties. And then the next thing you know, these guys were just clean and they were shining and they looked strong. And then the next thing you know, Minister Farrakhan comes out and he starts speaking. And the intellect that he spoke with was so profound to me that I was like, this is where I want to be.
Right.
So I'm saying that to say to you two things. First of all, did you find out anything about how the uniform of the Nation of Islam came about? Because that was something that was very attractive, and I would believe, and I don't know, I'm asking you this, did that uniform, was this, did you find out anything about why it was designed or how it was designed or what was the time that they transitioned into the uniform stage?
No, sir, but you have just piqued my curiosity. And really, it's a for me, in my thinking, it's a sense of urgency that we talk to those pioneers who may know the answer. And I have a couple in mind as we speak who I'm going to make it my business to call and to ask them, because one thing about writing this book and why I encourage everybody to write a book, even if it's or just make a video or something, because a lot of this important history we have lost because people have passed away. And so what you're asking me now, it really moves me to call some people as soon as possible to ask that question, because we need to get that information before these people pass away or they become victims of Alzheimer's or whatever, and
yes.
We're losing too much valuable history. So you had just given me another assignment, and I thank you for it.
You know, the reason why I found that interesting, and you know, is because, and I'm making this reference, and I'm making this reference on the basis of, I want you to know that I saw a film about the rise of Adolf Hitler and how he had influenced the German people. And it, when you look at the rise of Adolf Hitler, he basically came with a shirt and a tie, I mean, it was, there was a time that there was a transition that happened, and he started to go into something like pageantry, you know, where he started to dress up as men, and he started to use banners, and he started to use all these other things, and that was what also helped to attract and motivate people to become part of his movement. But I saw that, I believe, that the beauty of that uniform and brothers wanting to put that uniform on and sisters wanting to, you know, dress in those MGT uniforms, that there was something that was, you know, there was a pageantry. I'm calling it pageantry, but that okay. uniform was significant to being an attractive an attractive force to get people to become part of the Nation of Islam.
Well, and what you're saying, what came to my mind as you were saying that, now, and I'm not sure, I don't know as much about Adolf Hitler and his dress, but I do know from my own life experience, even as young as being in the Cub Scout, Boy
yes.
Scout, in high school in ROTC, man, they can make you feel good about their uniform, and you want to look good in their uniform.
That's
and then
right.
the compliments that you got from people when they saw you in their uniform, you know, like it makes you feel good. You say, thank you
yeah.
very much, man. Thank
yeah.
you very much, sir. And then you would go home and polish. I mean, I remember getting out that lasso and polishing each button on my ROTC uniform because I wanted to look good, make sure each button was straight, that the letters when I turned side was crooked. You know, so now here is a black man with his uniform, African-American, I don't like saying black, but African-American with his uniform in the NOI. Oh, yes. I mean, that gave him, and he said, we have our own, you know, this didn't come from no one's thinking except for teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. That gave their brother a very good sense of pride of saying, I have my own uniform.
Yes.
I mean, and the sisters, you know, wearing that dress, and you can see many of the pictures of the Savior Day, the dress where you just see a sea of white, you know, all up in the upper balconies with the sisters down to wearing white gloves, you know, and white, I mean, it was just together.
Yes.
You know, so it was a sense of belonging, a sense of ownership and purpose, and in the back of your mind, you're saying, and it didn't come from the white man. That was important.
Yes.
That was super important. This came from the mind of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I mean, that right there gave a person a sense of pride that can't be replaced in the sense of what man can give to man. I don't think they can top that is what God gave to man.
Yes. You know, the other part that I wanted to mention was also on the materialism, the acquisition of things like restaurants and bean pies. In particular, And when I came into the Nation of Islam, they had the Salam restaurant on 116th Street. And as you know, in Harlem, from what I understand, the temple had been burnt down because it was bombed or something like that, and then it was rebuilt over.
Right.
And there was this, I mean, it was just a fascinating looking place. I mean, it looked different from everything else. And when you would go into the Salam restaurant, before I became a Muslim, I was afraid to go into the Salam restaurant because, I mean, it was just, I was just too used to going to fish and chip joints and barbecue.
Yeah.
So you talk about going into a restaurant, like, no, this place is just too high class for me, you know, but there was the materialism aspect of it. I'm mentioning that on the basis, I know that the Honorable Master Elijah Muhammad had something to do with it, but Farrakhan had something to do with that in New York too. The other part was that Farrakhan, you know, he drove a custom made Mercedes Benz.
Okay, I didn't know that, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, when I say that it was custom made, I mean it was just a little longer than the regular Mercedes Benz. It wasn't like, you know, real long, but it was just a little longer than the regular Mercedes Benz.
Yes, sir.
You know, but there was this materialism thing that was attractive to, you know, many, I believe many African American people that kind of attracted us to the Nation. I know that was one of the attractions for me.
Well, you know, and that reminds me of a saying, the haves and the have-nots. And I'm going to use that phrase in a more positive way to a degree. Because when you come from a people that, by and large, have a history of not having, then we are attracted to somebody who has something. And in particular, a display of success, a display of wealth, of order, of being in order and being clean. And that was very important within the Nation of Islam. And to a strong degree, it should be important now because we should want to be a physical demonstration that manifests the knowledge we have. We have to have an outer expression of what's looking on us on the inside. So those who have not, look at those who have and be impressed to say, well, if they can have some, maybe I can have some too. Now, we know the other side of it is, and now that we are more grown in our understanding of Islam, Allah tells us to get our share of this materialism, of this, we call it the dunya, to get our share of this materialism, but then Allah says, but don't forget the hereafter, don't forget the life to come, so that we do not fall victim to materialism to where it begins to dominate us. And that was a problem for a period within the Nation of Islam, to where the good side of materialism was there, but if you're not careful and not remain balanced, then materialism will, like judo, it'll flip you, and you think you're on top of it, and no, it'd be on top of you. So there was a balancing act that had to be maintained, and that was one of the beauties. Whereas after 1975, when Imam W.D. Muhammad became the leader, he was able to really bring about the balance, still seek the material good, but don't become materialistic.
You know, we're an hour is almost up, but there's a couple of other. I wanted to, you know, definitely mention a couple of things. One was Muhammad Ali, and it seemed like Muhammad Ali was similar to you to some degree. Whereas it says that Muhammad Ali's life and time, that his first encounter with the Nation of Islam was 1959, and then someone else said that no, it was 1964. But what I really found that was interesting about what you wrote was that it says Clay's first encounter with the Nation of Islam in 1959 while attending the Golden Gloves tournament in Chicago, where Cassius Clay purchased a record recording of Elijah Muhammad a record recording of Elijah Muhammad? They had records during their time.
Records have been around. I mean, even if you had to go home and crank it up with the old machine, I mean, but the report from the research that I had done, one was from his best friend, even to this day, Howard Bingham. You know, and Howard Bingham to this day is Muhammad Ali's best friend. You know, he's Muhammad Ali's personal photographer. And when he gives a report, Howard Bingham, in his book, I can't think of the title of his book right now, but that when Muhammad Ali, while in high school, he did his class report on the Nation of Islam while in high school. So that would go back definitely to the Muhammad Ali was born in 1942. So you figure 1960, roughly when he came out of high school. So if you follow that timeline, it does make sense. But yeah, I mean, I was raised in the house in the 60s and going back to the 50s. When we had records, we had albums. It was music, of course. You know, so so what I had done in my book, as you will see, that I have a long list of my sites in the bibliography of my book.
Yes.
Then you can go there and you can find the source that I quoted from.
Yes, and it says here, you was just talking about, the paper says, when he turned to the essay a few days later, his teacher, a black woman, was livid. She marched him right into the principal Atwood Wilson's office and demanded disciplinary action be taken. The principal turned the matter over to the school's guidance counselor, Betty Johnston. This quote says, I went to school with his parents and knew the family quite well. It was obvious from the paper that he was well-versed in the doctrines of the Muslims and that he admired them.
Muhammad Ali in high school.
Yes. But it also said, the other interesting point that you make in the book is right after that, says 2 days late after dethroning Charles Sonny Liston to become the world's youngest heavyweight champion, Cassius Clay publicly disclosed on February 27th that he was a member of the Nation of Islam. So he has been thinking about this for a long time.
Yes, he had. Yes, you know, I mean, he may have been the same as I was. I said, well, when I get grown, I'm going to be a black Muslim, you know.
Yes.
You know, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yes, as far as Muhammad Ali is concerned, I mean, he was another person that kind of did the same thing that Malcolm X did. That Malcolm X would say, you know, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said. And then when Muhammad Ali would win a fight, he would say, all praise is due to Allah for the Honorable Matthew, what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
That's right. As a matter of fact, even after the fight with George Foreman, the Rumble in the Jungle. And in my research, because you keep researching, I mean, even now you keep researching, and I came across the interview with David Frost, the one that where everyone hears from Muhammad Ali after he done beat Sonny Liston, and he was saying, now it says Sonny Liston was a baby. He said, when you got Allah by your side and you got the Honorable Elijah Muhammad by your side, he said, can't nobody stop you. But then I found a further piece of the same interview that is hard to find. David Frost asked him later, he said, Muhammad, is this the greatest day of your life? And Ali says, no, man. The greatest day of my life is when I met Elijah Muhammad. And this is the same night. And he's still sweating. He's still wearing his trunks from the fight. And he makes this statement. You know, so even, and this is important because before the fight, Elijah Muhammad and Muhammad Ali had a rift, that they were not as close during that time period, because Elijah Muhammad was telling Muhammad Ali to quit boxing and come in and be a minister, you know, come and work for him. And Ali disobeyed, and he went on with the fight. Where before that fight, Elijah Muhammad told Herbert, he said, tell Muhammad Ali, he said, you fight because you're fighting for our people.
Wow.
And that was before that was the same night he fought Foreman before the fight. Herbert got that word to him, my father said that you are fighting for our people. After the fight, he came back and he reciprocated and said, well, Allah is with you. He didn't want to stop you, and when Elijah Muhammad is with you, you know, that statement there.
So, very powerful.
Very powerful, because what we have to look at with where, even with Imam Muhammad, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, I use those three, when they had to go their separate ways, if you follow their story, even with Malcolm X, although it's harder to see with Malcolm X, they still thought ways to come back together. And the reason why it's so hard to see with Malcolm X, because FBI and others, I tell them what happened, they were sending negative letters, false negative letters, to Elijah Muhammad and to Malcolm X to keep them from coming together.
Now, I want to mention something else. That with, as we progress through the book, this was another interesting chapter where you say, who was Carl Evans?
Carl Evans, he's the author who wrote a book called The Rise and Fall of Elijah Muhammad. The Rise and the Fall of Elijah Muhammad.
And I just want to read this. It says that in that book he states that Elijah Muhammad also hired white people. Evans points out that the Lerner family, a Jewish family, printed Muhammad Speaks, and that Elijah hired Caucasians to handle the finances of the Nation of Islam. According to Evans, Elijah defended this action by saying, I can get along with both, and the white people know this country, know their government, know their buildings, their material, and if my people would build those houses over there, referring to his new mansions, they would have to buy the material from the white people.
Yes, sir. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because we have to come to, I believe we have to come to the conclusion that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad of 1933 was not the same Honorable Elijah Muhammad of 1975. He kept his mission of freeing black people and making them self-sufficient, but he also had the ability to adjust and to adapt to the changing circumstances or the changing seasons. So his message in the end to white people was almost 180 degrees different from his position from years before, to the point where he even criticized black people for making white people. He said, don't blame the white man for being who he is. You're the one that made him. And then also, in 1974, on this last Savior's Day, he had two Caucasian Muslims on the stage with him. And he was telling his people to respect the white man and his flag. So he and working, what the point that Carl Evans brings out are some important points, because the Lerner family is a Caucasian Jewish family. They were making more money printing Muhammad Speaks than what they were printing their own paper. You know, so I guess it was also a business decision, but on the part of Elijah Muhammad, he had no problem working with white people. He would invite them to his house and have dinner with him using his finest dishes, you know, china. He invited in white people to his house. So we need to look at Elijah Muhammad differently from what has been fed to us by the major media and by Hollywood, and even by, sad to say, even by some African-American historians who don't have the courage to tell the whole story, to tell the whole truth. Because Elijah Muhammad invited white people to his house, that's powerful. Could you imagine Bull Connor or old George Wallace inviting someone black to come to their house for a dinner?
No, I couldn't imagine it.
You know, he may invite them in the back door to come wash the dishes, you know, cook food, something like that. You know, but here's Elijah Muhammad, supposed to be the man who hates white folks, and they come to his house for a dinner. He got them in business, kind of his money.
Yeah.
You know, so now we got to reassess how we have been fed the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Also, for Dr. King, they give us this polished, this sugar-coated idea of Dr. King. We need to see a more rounded human, Dr. King, then we can really benefit from his message more. And same for all of our great leaders.
You know, now I want to talk to you about Imam Wallace Dean Muhammad, who you also mentioned as one of the men of the Honorable Master Elijah Muhammad. But in your book, you say that it says that during a lengthy interview that was conducted by his brother Herbert, Wallace spoke of his upbringing and described himself as being a child of the mission.
Yes, sir.
So that was something that was he was supposed to carry on the mission of the Honorable Master Elijah Muhammad.
Yeah, well, there was a charge given to Imam Muhammad before he was born from Mr. W. D. Farad.
You called it Chore, a C-H-O-R-E?
I'm sorry, Charge, C-H-A-R-G-E, Charge.
Okay.
Yeah, he was given, I guess you could say both Chore or Charge, but I'm saying with the G-E, that he told Elijah Muhammad to name your son after me, and he would be your helper in this work. So
now this was before he was born. Wallace D. Muhammad was born.
Yes, it was before he was born, while he was in the womb of his mother.
Okay, I just want to let people know what we're talking about. Wallace D. Muhammad was born on October 30th, 1933. So this was before he was born in 1933.
Yes, sir. Before he was born, he was in the womb of his mother. And Mr. Farad went to Elijah Muhammad and told him, you're going to have a boy, name your son after me. And there was a door. But he went to the wall behind the door and wrote on the wall, Wallace D. Muhammad.
Now, who wrote that? Farad wrote that, Wallace wrote that?
No, Wallace wasn't born yet. Mr. Farad wrote that in chalk and gave the instruction to the older brothers and sisters. He said, when this chalk fades, go over it again so that it won't fade totally out. And they've done that for years, or months, or whatever. I'm not sure how long they've done it, but they followed the instructions. They would retrace what Mr. Farad had wrote on the wall behind the door, and he wrote his name, Wallace D. Muhammad, for them to name the baby in the womb after him. So when Wallace Muhammad was born, I mean, he already got a responsibility upon him from the day he took his first breath. And so then he's raised and groomed as a child for the mission. That's what his statement was referring to. You know, he was raised and groomed from diapers to succeed his father. And so at the age of 40, he came back because, you know, along the way, he and his father disagreed on some important issues, and mainly in theological ideals, because Wallace Muhammad could not bow the idea that Farad Muhammad was God. And so, and other issues to where sometimes his father would put him out. But the last time he put him out, he came back in June of 1974 at the age of 40, and his father allowed him to begin teaching. And at the Temple No. 2 in Chicago, and I heard from Imam Yusuf Shaw, not the Yusuf Shaw from New York, was the one from Chicago, and he would say that when Imam Muhammad began teaching in 74, going into 75, that the membership of the meetings grew until they had to come out of the basement and go back upstairs into the main assembly room. So, as you all know, even in New York, Imam made it to New York in January of 1975, about a month before his father died, and done a very powerful talk. You know, as he was, because his father had given him the license or the freedom to teach, even though they knew his teachings was different, they still gave him the license to teach as he felt free to teach. And keep in mind, there's an obligation from when he was born from Mr. W.D. Farrar, saying that this child in this womb will be the helper to this mission. So he was a child
on, on page 170 of the book, you say Elijah Muhammad still had to fulfill his charge of raising Wallace with special care so that he would be a helper to himself and Farrar's work. I mentioned that because also on this page is the picture of W.D. Farrar reading the Quran with Elijah Muhammad sitting down, W.D. Muhammad, Wallace Muhammad standing with his hand on his shoulder and offering out the Quran in the front. See, I always found this to be a very profound picture. What
yes,
can
sir.
You tell us about that?
Well, what we heard from Imam Muhammad, the picture was taken by Gordon Parks, the famous photographer Gordon Parks.
Gordon
said,
Parks?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
I didn't
yeah,
know
he's
that.
One of the, yeah, he's the photographer that took the picture. And Imam Muhammad said he was not invited over for that picture. He was coming by for something else, and his father seen him and said, come here, son, you know, and then they posed for that picture. And so it's in the room of the house called the Pine Room, P-I-N-E, because all the wood in their room was made from pine trees. And so they get called it the Pine Room. And that's where that picture was taken. And so, and no one else was given that picture. No one else was allowed to take that same pose to where his father told him, you put your hand on my shoulder, your right hand on my shoulder, and put and hit the Quran in his left hand. And so, now, Elijah Muhammad, if you know in the picture, he's sitting down and his son is standing. And that's how that picture was taken. And it just suggests to the mind of this continuity. Farrar is in the upper picture. Elijah Muhammad sitting down and Imam Muhammad's there, as if that is the line of transmission for this work.
That's beautiful.
And if I may add in a note, I was blessed to do the Juma here in Los Angeles at Masjid Bilal Ibn Rabah, where Imam Ayman Abdul Majid is the resident Imam. And in the Friday Coop Bar, I said to the believers, I said, we are part of a three-phase miracle. And the three phases, it began with the work of Mr. W.D. Farrar, continued to maintain by the works of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and found this fulfillment in Imam W.D. Muhammad. And we are the products of this three-phase miracle. And so if we speak about that picture, that concept comes to my mind once again, that what Allah has done with this community and the direction and the focus he has given to us, you know, as the Quran says to each of you, is a goal that Allah faces you. Now, and no community of people, I don't care if you're Chinese or Russian or whatever, no one chooses the direction that Allah is going to face us. We just take what Allah has given us. And so slavery and Jim Crow and depression and the civil rights movement and the Nation of Islam, those are, that's a focus that Allah gave us that we didn't choose. But when we look at the results that have came from, going back to that phrase I coined, three-phase miracle, it's a good feeling to be a part of this movement and to be of the spiritual and mental lowings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And so of these four men in this book, there are many of us who have been touched by this great man, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, through those four men mentioned in this book.
You know, I want you to tell us, we haven't said too much about Imam W.D. Muhammad. We did mention the specialness of him, but over the, was it 40 years from 1975 until his passing, what, 30 years, is that correct?
I think it was 33 years.
The 33 years of his of his mission, what was it that he accomplished that was significant to the landscape of Islam in America, to the African American people, and to the international world, which motivated you to basically write about him?
Yes, his father groomed him to be a thinker. And not only his father, but his mother as well, because not only was Elijah Muhammad given the responsibility to raise Wallace, right, his mother was also given that same charge. So they told him all through his life, son, question everything. And he questioned everything, and he would read and he would study. He would study Quran, he would study Bible, he would study mythologies. And it ended up being that he was able to give us a body of knowledge or a way of thinking and a method of even looking at knowledge. Even before we began to try to digest it or break it down, it was just the way to even approach knowledge is so special and unique until it is a refreshing understanding that had come from that. And when he took us into the faith of into the field of interfaith, and as we engage with our Christian brothers and sisters and our Jewish and brothers and sisters and others, they see and appreciate what we have to share. And then we talk to many of our Muslim brothers from overseas, and I have heard this a number of times, and maybe you have too, and those listening may have heard them say that the hope for Islam is in the hands of the African-American Muslims. I heard this said a number of times. And this came about because of the intellect that Allah had blessed Imam W.D. Muhammad, Wallace D. Muhammad, to have. And he spent hours and days and months giving us his knowledge. And he gets poured it on us. So those of us who became his students were able to go and now share it. So his contribution that made him respected by the Pope of Rome. I was there in June of 1999 when he spoke before Pope John Paul. I mean, there were 200 world leaders there. They only chose 5 out of the 200 to speak. The third one to speak was Imam Wallace D. Muhammad.
Wow.
And Pope John Paul, the Dalai Lama was there. And it was the whole Vatican City Square was full of people packed and shown on international TV around the Catholic world. And the beauty of it all, when he had that audience, he mentioned his father in his speech. He said, my father conditioned me to be this way, to reach out to people. That is a powerful statement to where you are now on the international scene, and you do not forget your origin, where you came from. And at Morehouse College, Dr. Carter, they put Imam Muhammad's picture up along with the great people that carry on the work of Gandhi and King and other great leaders. And this Dr. Carter, Lawrence Carter, and he was telling Imam Muhammad during this induction of his picture, he said, I was over in Rome, over in Italy, and he said, and I saw your picture on the wall, not once but twice, along with Thierry Lubick, a vocal laureate movement, and along with Pope John Paul. And he said, he's over here now, here's an African-American scholar, Dr. Lawrence, from in Atlanta. He go overseas, and he's looking at all these great leaders, and they're on the wall, you damn W.D. Muhammad, over in Italy. This is a powerful day for us, a wonderful day for us, and we thank Allah for putting us. He chose to put us through slavery, Jim Crow, oppression, and then to have this what I call a three-phase miracle, W.D. Farrar, Elijah Muhammad, Ibn Muhammad, to come out of that, and now the whole world is respecting this. The whole world respects Lewis Falk on Mr. Lewis Falk on that people made, and some people got mad at me. Some of my good brothers and sisters got mad at me because I mentioned Mr. Farrakhan in the book. I said, it's the history. If he does some good, I'm going to put it in the book.
Well, you know, it's not only that. You know, I was something that I had to contend with myself as far as the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. But, you know, Allah blessed Minister Farrakhan to continue with the Nation of Islam. I mean, he couldn't have continued. I mean, you and I were just talking about how Marcus Garvey got in trouble as far as some income taxes or whatever, and his movement, you know, kind of died. We were talking about how Noble Drew Ali's movement became, you know, somewhat on the back burner. But, you know, the only way that things can be successful, and this is the way that we've come to understand it because of some of the things that have been shared with us as far as Imam W.D. Muhammad, is, you know, Allah's the Akbar. And, you know, he puts you on that path. And, I mean, Minister Farrakhan brought back the Nation of Islam, and that's just the fact of the matter.
Yes, sir. Yeah, you know. And the only thing I would add to that is that he was the most successful because there were many brothers who tried to silence. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yes.
You know, and many others, they have, and they, even to this day, they have their own smaller versions, but the most successful one to bring back the closest resemblance, and I have to say it that way.
The what, the social?
The closest or the nearest to a resemblance of what you like to come here has been the success of Mr. Louis Farrakhan.
Right.
Because I have to say, because this was what is the truth, the Nation of Islam of the Honorable Muhammad is not identical to the Nation of Islam under Minister Louis Farrakhan.
Right.
For example, because they now have Juma prayer, they now have certain names are holy names, and that didn't happen commonly under Elijah Muhammad. They're getting involved into elections and in the politics. These are all good things. These are all evolutions out of, you know, so we can respect that. And we have to give credit to where credit is due.
Yes.
And Mr. Louis Farrakhan has been successful, and he has. And I deeply appreciate the brothers who used to have their pants sagging down and a nickel bag of reefer in their pocket now standing on the corner selling from the call. I'd rather have them there selling from the call wearing a suit and tie and being a dignified man who's going to go home and take care of his family than the person they used to be. They used to be a thug, you know, with their pants hanging down but going.
Right, standing on the corner instead of selling Muhammad Sheikh, selling drugs to the people in the community.
That's right. So now they using that same skill as Malcolm transferred his skill from negativity into positivity, these same brothers under Mr. Louis Farrakhan are now standing clean, straight, and tall. We have to applaud that.
Yes. Well, you know, I will say that one of what I really, really took away from this book was that you mentioned just the historical perspective in bringing it from, actually you brought it from Farad Muhammad to Elijah Muhammad and then on through the transition of Malcolm X, Minister Farrakhan, Muhammad Ali, and Imam W.D. Muhammad. But what these men have in common, these four men that you have mentioned, is a development as far as their intellect is concerned and their culture was concerned, that these were not stupid, backwards people. These were thinking men. These were intellectual men, the men that were able to reason and were able to take their reasoning and put it on the national and international stage and actually make a contribution to society. And I'll tell you this here.
Yes, sir.
You have recorded that in your book, but what you have also done, like I mentioned at the very beginning of the show, how you were inspired to actually write that book. I think that there are many of us that Allah has inspired to do some of the things that we're doing today. Far as whatever it is that we're involved in, there seems to be this personal inspiration that I find that many people in the, especially in particular, the community of Imam W.D. Muhammad, who are sincerely motivated to grow and develop and to do things. Some may be writing books, but what we're doing here with the Muslim American Media Alliance is we're putting in the front some of the people that are actually taking their inspiration and being involved in media. And, Brother Imam, we thank you so very much, man, for the work that you have done as far as writing this book. It's an historical contribution. It's a piece of media that we pray that other people will read. They should read it. And as a matter of fact, let's give them that website that they can go to actually get that book.
Oh, yes. Yes. That is www.wordsmakepeople.com. Wordsmakepeople.com.
Yeah. And we encourage you all to buy this book. It's a book that you should read. It's an excellent reference book, and we pray that Allah will continue to bless you, Brother Imam, with the work that you've been doing. And I thank you so very much for taking the time to be with us on Meet the Mama Members. May Allah continue to bless you. As-salamu alaykum.
Alaykum as-salam, and may Allah continue to bless you and your show with much success. And thank you for having me on as your guest.
All right, brother.
Thank you for listening to Muslim American Media Alliance right here on A New Day for Al-Islam in America Community Radio.